people in Alaska have just immense amount of power right now because of this quirk that Senator Murkowski is now part of the Senate Republican leadership.
Alaskans hear from a proponent of nuclear arms reduction. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 14th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Cape Fox Native Corporation fights 8A suspension.
The company is sound financially. We are in litigation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski will be key to a vote to reduce nuclear weapons worldwide when the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, comes before the U.S. Senate later this year. A member of the Senate Republican leadership, Murkowski is one of several Republican senators to be courted by nuclear weapons experts working to get the START Treaty ratified.
People in Alaska really do have an immense amount of power right now concerning nuclear weapons policy for the United States and really for the whole world.
That's David Culp, one of only six registered lobbyists on nuclear disarmament in Washington, D.C. A lobbyist for the Quakers Friends Committee on National Legislation, Culp will be speaking next week on the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. The first START treaty between the United States and former Soviet Union, signed in 1991, expired last year. President Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed the latest pack in April. It must now be ratified. Culp says talking to Murkowski's Alaska constituents is one of the most effective things he can do to convince her to vote on the treaty.
The Russians are going to ratify this treaty. Everybody's looking to the United States. So people in Alaska have just immense amount of power right now because of this quirk that Senator Murkowski is now part of the Senate Republican leadership.
The new START treaty calls for a 30% reduction in the number of U.S. and Russian-deployed strategic nuclear weapons.
Right now, there's 2,200 strategic weapons. This means missiles, bombers, and so on, aimed at the United States. There's also 2,200 aimed at Russia. At the end of the Cold War, there simply is no need for these thousands of nuclear weapons to be aimed at each other.
The START Treaty was introduced in the Senate on Wednesday. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will hear it for the first time next week. Murkowski will be at that hearing, according to the Senator's Communications Director, Mike Brumis. He says she hasn't formed an opinion on the treaty yet, and she will listen to her constituents. Only two Republican senators have taken a position on the treaty. Indiana's Richard Lugar, the ranking Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, supports it. Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe is working against it. Culp says the biggest challenge will be getting the treaty up for a vote in the nearly dysfunctional Senate. He hopes it will be on the floor by August, and a moderate like Murkowski can help get the bill to the floor.
On the merits of the treaty, I actually think the majority of the Republican caucus supports it. But there are definitely members of the Senate that feel that nothing should pass, and that the best thing they can do is vote against everything.
Culp will explain the START Treaty and other accords to reduce nuclear weapons in Juneau on Sunday at the Egan Library on the UAS campus, next Wednesday in Anchorage at the Wilda Marston Theater in the Lusac Library, and Friday in Fairbanks at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Authorities say one man is dead following a plane crash near Willow in south-central Alaska. Alaska State Troopers received the report about 2 p.m. today. Spokeswoman Beth Ebsen says the victim was the only person aboard. His identity wasn't released pending notification of relatives. Ebsen said a witness reported the plane clipping a tree before crashing. Saxman-based Cape Fox Corporation is enmeshed in a criminal investigation that could have consequences for the Native Corporation's 8A government contracting status. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
According to the online publication Alaska Dispatch, Cape Fox's business connections with California businessman Townsend Jackson have soured to the point that the Native Corporation is suing Jackson and a number of companies that Jackson owns for $27 million in damages. Townsend Jackson is listed on a LinkedIn web page as president of APM LLC, a company that Cape Fox owns. According to the dispatch, the tricky thicket of litigation started last fall when the U.S. Air Force discovered that some 20 companies were taking advantage of the 8A government contracting special preference for Native-owned businesses. Six of the companies have connections to Cape Fox, and the rest are tied to Jackson and some Jackson relatives. The Air Force claims that the 20 companies in question received some $700 million in lucrative government defense contracts illegally. Because a Small Business Administration investigation discovered that APM never received SBA clearance for the management contracts it entered into with its business partners. APM was accepted into the 8A program in 2003, and shortly afterwards, Townsend Jackson allegedly began hiding information from the SBA about APM's growing business partnerships. Size does matter in 8A contracts, since the program is designed to help disadvantaged businesses. About $136 million worth of contracts are affected, some paid for with stimulus funds. A Jigsaw page lists Jackson as owner of Arctic Pipe and Materials, one of the companies under scrutiny. Calls to the business, located in Yorba Linda, California, deadheaded.
Hello, you've called a number that used to be in connection to APM. This is no longer a viable number to reach APM.
A call to another Jackson business called Sanders, also in Yorba Linda, gained the information that Jackson was no longer with the company. Calls to Cape Fox CEO Mike Brown were returned, however. Brown says the Alaska Dispatch got it all wrong.
Well, there's a lot of factual mistakes in it.
Brown says it is not even close to true that Cape Fox is facing financial devastation.
The company is sound financially. We are in litigation. The names in the article are not accurate, but I'll pass you on to our attorney, Mr. Walker, and he can respond to any details about the litigation that he cares to share with you.
Attorney Bill Walker is traveling and not available for comment today. APM and the other companies involved have had their 8A status suspended. Cape Fox is suing Jackson and his brother Craig Jackson in federal court, charging that both men took APM money for personal use and that Craig Jackson used at least one of the 8A businesses for his own profit. And Cape Fox, as the parent company, still has to prove why it should not be dropped from the 8A program. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The South Central Alaska Native Corporation Chugach Management Services has agreed to pay $822,000 for using cheap steel in security fences at McChord Air Force Base near Tacoma, Washington. Chugach Management Services did not admit any wrongdoing in the settlement reached with the Defense and Justice Departments. The company is based in Anchorage. The Seattle U.S. Attorney's Office said Chugach was awarded a contract for four fencing projects at McChord. In each project, the company billed the government for high-grade steel, but actually used steel that was far lighter and cheaper. Prosecutors say the $822,000 fine is double the amount the company overbilled the government. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a possible ban on lead fuel for aviation.
We're affected far more than any other state in the country. All of our, you know, small remote communities without the large airships, these guys are all running in with piston engine aircraft.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, working to permit the Red Dog Mine so it can produce for Alaska for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com.
Alaska aviators worry a proposed government ban on leaded fuel will impact flights to rural communities. The Environmental Protection Agency is considering a rule prohibiting lead in fuel used by piston-driven aviation engines. Most small planes use the engines and cannot operate with unleaded fuel. Congressman Don Young is attacking the idea as premature. He says it's not clear that lead from aviation fuel causes harm to people or the environment. Legislative Director Jeremy Price says Alaska has an uphill battle against the rule.
We're affected far more than any other state in the country. You know, all of our, you know, small remote communities, you know, without the large airstrips, these guys are all running in with piston engine aircraft, single into an engine. So, you know, nobody else has to deal with the issues with commerce and transportation to the different hubs.
The EPA recently determined lead from aviation fuel could endanger pilots, passengers, and people living near airports. It asked for suggestions from the aviation community and the general public. The Alaska Air Carriers Association says a lead fuel ban would affect a large percentage of the state's small planes. The EPA's efforts are in response to a petition filed by the environmental group Friends of the Earth. The organization says lead from aviation fuel can cause brain damage, lowered IQ levels, and increase blood pressure. Calls to the EPA and Friends of the Earth were not immediately returned. A leading opponent of the Pebble Mine Project is making his case against the mine in communities around southeast Alaska this week. As Deanna Garrison from KRBD reports, the advocacy group Renewable Resources Coalition is considering a new statewide ballot initiative targeting Pebble Mine operations.
Owner of an international investment firm, Bob Gillum, is by most accounts the state's richest man. He's also helping to bankroll the Renewable Resources Coalition, which is leading the charge against the Pebble Mine project.
I looked around and I saw a few Alaskans that had the wherewithal or the time or the money to say no to some international mining consortiums. Remember, these mining companies make billions and billions of dollars, and they want the minerals. So somebody needs to say no, and somebody needs to stick up for the little guy, and especially the people in the villages in the area.
Gillum spoke before Ketchikan's Rotary 2000 Tuesday about his group's opposition to the Pebble Mine. Staff wouldn't allow the presentation to be recorded, but Gillum granted an interview following the Rotary speech. Gillum says he's generally pro-mining.
This battle is not about mining. It's about this mine in this place.
English and Canadian mining companies estimate there are approximately 42 billion pounds of copper and 40 million ounces of gold at Pebble. Gillum says a mine would produce 10 billion tons of waste. He fears Pebble would threaten Bristol Bay's prized sockeye salmon fishery.
It's the location. The location sits at the exact headwaters of the Kwajalein River and the Nooshinggak, which are the two most important salmon rivers in Bristol Bay. So what happens is that any pollution, especially copper and all the bad minerals that come out of this, runs downhill. Every single one of the 20 largest copper producing mines in the world, 100% of them have pollution problems. You can't stand that kind of a pollution situation around salmon.
Pebble proponents say Gillum is using his considerable financial wealth to single-handedly stop Pebble. Proponents have even created a website called BobGillumCan'tBuyAlaska.com. They say the only reason Gillum is opposing the mine is because he operates a lodge in the area.
The claim that I have a lodge was a gigantic lie of the mining companies. They know that I do not have a lodge. And in fact, what I have is a home. I have a home on Lake Clark, and I've been there for over 25 years.
Mining companies say Pebble would be one of the largest copper mines in the world. The worth of the entire deposit of all minerals is estimated between $300 and $500 billion. Gillum says the economic benefit to the state and southwest Alaska would be limited compared to the financial benefits of the Bristol Bay fishery.
Remember that there are 6,300 Bristol Bay 12-month-a-year fishing jobs here. Remember that there's $450 million a year net to the Alaskan economy out of this. We get that forever. But if we pollute it, we will lose this, and we lose it forever. So you can't have both.
In 2008, voters rejected a clean water measure that would have impeded development of the Pebble Mine. Gillum and the Renewable Resources Coalition are looking at a new statewide initiative targeting Pebble. This one would require the state to adopt standards for the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. The group has yet to file a petition application with the State Division of Elections. Gillum visited Ketchikan and Wrangell this week. Earlier this spring, he spoke in Sitka and Juneau. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Sea Alaska Native Corporation has started a new division to focus on economic initiatives in Southeast Alaska. It shares the name of the regional Native Corporation's lands selection effort, but officials say it will have a wider focus. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details.
Sea Alaska began almost 40 years ago by investing in state, but it's moved far from its original fisheries and timber businesses. Now it has a high-tech metal fabrication plant in Washington State. It's in plastics with branches in Iowa, Alabama, and Mexico. It's invested in a pair of California casinos, and it markets furniture from Vietnam and Brazil. Now it's looking at business closer to home, with a new division called Ha'ani.
This is very much focused on southeastern Alaska.
Chris McNeil is president and CEO of Sea Alaska, which has about 20,000 Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian shareholders.
Our board of directors, concluded that without that very directed effort, it would be very difficult to not only have an actual plan, but accountability for the effort within the region.
Sea Alaska's best-known panhandle business is its timber company. That will remain separate. But McNeil says Ha'ani is overseeing some other Southeast subsidiaries.
For example, it would have responsibility for our rock, sand, and gravel management. It would, issues like looking at oyster farming would be under Ha'ani. Any other efforts that we would have concerning renewable energy.
Ha'ani means our land. It's also the name of Sea Alaska's controversial campaign to select acreage outside of boundaries set by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. There's no guarantee legislation granting those selections will make it through Congress, and if it does, new logging would remain under the corporation's timber subsidiary. But McNeil says Ha'ani would manage ecotourism and other businesses developed on what Sea Alaska is calling Native Futures sites. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A 25-mile Yukon River ice jam threatening to flood the village of Ruby has broken and is now flowing. But residents of Galena are hoping the ice doesn't get caught in a horseshoe bend in the river 20 miles downstream of the community of 700. City Manager Tom Corrigan says if the ice chunks get trapped there, the river level upstream would rise and flood Galena. That hasn't happened yet, but the moving ice has raised the water level around town by about 12 feet, and some low-lying areas have had minor flooding. Corrigan says water also has crept near the main road linking two sections of Galena. Emergency supplies, including cots and backup generators, remain in place in each part of the village.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Volunteer firefighting is a rewarding and extraordinary way to serve your community. It takes dedication, sacrifice, leadership, as well as mental and physical stamina. Emergency calls throughout Alaska continue to rise, but the number of volunteer firefighters continues to decline. Learn how you can experience the excitement and satisfaction of becoming a volunteer firefighter. Visit asfafireline.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska State Firefighters Association.
In Sitka, two brown bear cubs were shot and killed by authorities yesterday after they were discovered near their dead mother. The death of the sow, who had been shot, has been deemed an illegal kill. From member station KCAW, Ed Ronco has the story.
Police and wildlife officials already were familiar with the sow and two cubs, who were darted last Friday evening near the Cove Marina on Halibut Point Road. All three animals were given red and yellow ear tags. The sow received a white collar with a global positioning system receiver and a VHF radio signal. That allowed fish and game officials to track her. On Tuesday morning, another call came in that the sow was in some garbage near the golf course. Later that day, another call about the cubs this time. The bears were hazed away from the area each time. Another call on Wednesday evening, the sow and the cubs were on a porch in the area sniffing around. Officials tracked the sow's radio collar to the area near McConkie Street. They used beanbags to haze her and her cubs out of that area. Fish and Game wildlife biologist Phil Mooney picks up the story.
With the third shot that I had remaining, I had some rubber buckshot, and I shot essentially just to kind of hustle them along. And the sow, who was actually a ways in there, gave out a pretty good yelp and kind of surprised me, because that stuff doesn't penetrate. It's actually pretty puny stuff. And So we went back and got the radio call, the telemetry stuff, and tracked her, and she went out towards the golf course, which is only about 30 yards away, and all three of them were laying together. I thought that was kind of strange, so we went up to the point that she stood up, and then she turned to walk away, and it looked like she was dragging her left leg.
With no drugs or tranquilizers, the officials decided to hope that the sow would head back up over the golf course and into the woods. Mooney says another call came in on Thursday morning. The sow was in a ravine and appeared to be dead.
And when we arrived, she was, and she'd been there from the rigor mortis. She'd been there for a couple hours. So it didn't take too long for the cubs to show up, and they're still nursing on the sow. You could see that, and they wouldn't have lived, and they were only going to get themselves in trouble, so we killed both of them.
Mooney says the cubs were too small to survive on their own in a new location, and the male, who at 1 year old weighed about 100 pounds, already had demonstrated that he was not afraid of people. Officials were worried the situation would only escalate, and the state, he says, has a policy against taking in orphaned cubs older than 1 year. A necropsy of the sow shows that she had been shot as she was moving away from the shooter. The bullet broke the sow's femur, and Mooney says she bled to death. Her death is considered an illegal kill. Mooney says that investigation is ongoing. While trash is considered the bear's main attractant, Mooney says so is dredged material from Indian River, which is being deposited in a pit near the golf course.
Unfortunately, it smells pretty fishy, and Roger Sinikovich called the other morning from the golf course. This would have been 2 days ago, and they had seven bears standing out on the golf course, including the sow with two cubs. So they had come into the pit to check out that fish smell and then kind of dispersed from there.
In the meantime, officials urge everyone to look after their garbage. Keep the lids down and fastened if possible, or hold on to bear-attractant waste until pickup day. While Mooney says 9 out of 10 Sitkins are responsible with their garbage, he adds that all it takes is one can.
9 of your neighbors are doing a great job, and that the bear's coming in for neighbor number 10, and then he's walking around, and she's walking around to check out all the cans, and that puts that bear in the neighborhood. And so, you know, we have a little bit more aggressive effort this year to get in and talk to those people, and if they leave the material out, then they've risked a citation.
Sitka Police Lieutenant Barry Allen says officers are planning this year to be more proactive in enforcing the city's trash ordinance. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Frontier Airlines begins 4-day-a-week summer flights between Fairbanks and its Denver hub today. Frontier Vice President of Customer Service Cliff Van Leuven outlined his carrier's service at a Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce meeting this week. Van Leuven says Frontier will offer a quality travel experience and connections to a full range of destinations.
We fly Airbus airplanes. Airbus 319 will be here, 136 seats, leather interiors, live TV at every seat. We also have four rows in the front of the plane that have a stretch product with 5 additional inches of legroom. As I said, we serve 70 cities, 5 cities in Mexico, Costa Rica, Anchorage and Fairbanks, and pretty much all the big business cities and leisure markets in the lower 48.
Van Leuven said Frontier may expand to daily service if the Fairbanks demand supports it. Frontier's entry into the Fairbanks summer market introduces competition for the other two carriers that offer service to lower 48 destinations, Alaska Airlines and Delta. Monday kicks off Bike to Work Week in Anchorage. Friday is the biggest day when whole teams commute through the city. It's pretty clear that the number of people using bikes in the state's largest city is growing, but last year participation in the event actually went down. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The city actually posts counters at certain intersections, and those counters saw the number of bicycles grow from 1,422 in 2007 to 1,884 in 2008. But last year it was cold and wet, and you had to be pretty dedicated to saddle up that morning in the rain. The numbers were down slightly at 1,797. This year, the weather is also likely to be a factor. That's one of the reasons the city encourages the formation of teams. Ann Schlappia in the municipality's health department says a team provides some safety in numbers and some leadership.
frequently there's several riders in a business that may ride all year or ride frequently and know what they're doing, and then the others might want to join on for this occasion or this week, and the people with experience can help those who are less experienced.
So far, close to 100 teams have signed on, with a huge variety. Fort Richardson has not yet registered its team, but it's expected to. The oil companies have, as have the State Fish and Game Department and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then there are the peddling publishers, the small package handlers, the revenue rough riders, and the list goes on. There are a number of events tied in with Bike to Work Day next Friday, including a picnic and a free bike repair clinic at the Native Medical Center. It's all lined out on the municipal website where teams can also be registered, and where there will be a survey for participants to gather information about who cycles where and why.
It gives us a lot of good information. We're always interested in what motivates the riders, whether it's health, environment, to support their team. There's many different reasons, and many of them overlap, obviously. And some families, for instance, are able to have just one car in the family by having one of the partners bike commuting. So there are other financial considerations. And then, of course, being a tighter economy, some people are obliged to.
Local businesses have peddled into the Bicycle Act, not just by generating teams, but by donating quite a few prizes, which will be handed out at random to survey participants. The city's bicycle commuters proved earlier this year that they have some political clout when they and their bicycles showed up in large numbers as the Municipal Assembly considered the city's bicycle plan and passed it unanimously. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.